بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. So welcome everyone to this new course in which we will read and comment on the acts of worship, the ibadat found in the Met of Abi Shuja'a radiallahu anhu, which is an introductory text of the Shafi'i Madhab. We have five classes to do all of the ibadat, which is an enormous task. But there are a couple of points I want to say to address that. Number one is that in the university, the Wise University, we also have an app, the Wise University app, in which you can access all of the courses for free at the university level, in which we go through the same book, but in a much deeper way, a much slower way over several courses. So for people that are needing more information, because there will be a lot of questions that people will have that we just won't have time to get into, I recommend that. The other thing is the course, this course will be done completely in English. I will not be reading the Arabic out of time constraints. And we probably won't have much time for questions and answers, but we can also find another venue for that. So I'll just jump right in. قال المصنف رحمه الله ونفعنا بعلومه في الدارين آمين. So our author, he says, may Allah Ta'ala have mercy on him and may we benefit from his knowledge in this world and the next. All praises to Allah, Lord of the worlds. May the blessings of Allah be upon our liege Lord, the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and upon his pure household and his companions, one and all. The judge Abu Shuja' ibn al-Husayn ibn Ahmed al-Asfahani, may Allah Ta'ala grant him his mercy, said, one of my friends, may Allah Most High protect him, asked me to make a short treatise in law according to the school of Imam al-Shafi'i, rahimahullah, that is of the utmost concision and paramount brevity, so that its meanings become closer to the one studying it, easier for the novices to memorize. He also asked that I include numerous categories and encompass all properties. So I responded, seeking reward and desiring that Allah Ta'ala grant me success in doing the correct thing. Verily, he is capable of whatever he wishes and kind to and knowledgeable of his servants. So this is a common introduction in which most Muslim authors will actually state why they're writing the book. And one of the things that he says is that this is meant to be short, has many subgroups, subheadings, subheadings to make it easier to create in your mind a map of fiqh and that you can build on that map. So this book is a Mubarak book because it's the book that we study in the beginning of the Madhab, in the middle of the Madhab, and at the end of the Madhab. You can spend your whole life just studying this book with all of its commentaries and hawashi and glosses. And by memorizing the text, therefore you have in your mind this mental map and you'll know where to plug things in. Okay, so he says, Kitab al-Tahara, the book of purification. Of course, this is the prerequisite for prayer. So therefore, most of the discussions of fiqh we'll begin with that. Water. Purification is possible with seven types of water: rainwater, seawater, river water, well water, spring water, snow, and hail. So those seven things we can make wudu from, we can clean our clothes from, we can clean our utensils from, we can do ghusl from, so on and so forth. There are four categories of water. The first category is pure and purifying, not offensive to use. It is plain water. You go to the faucet, you open the faucet, the water there that's coming out of the faucet, it's pure and it's purifying. So it has the power to lift the state of ritual impurity, what we call al-hadath. It has the power to lift that so that you can make wudu. And there's no karaheya, there's no offensiveness to use. Number two is pure and purifying, the same as the first category, but it is offensive to use. There is karaheya in it. It is water irradiated by the sun, al-mushammas. So water that has been left outside, exposed by the sun, so it got too hot to use. You can still use it, but it's disliked to use it. Number three, pure yet not purifying. It is water that has been used to raise ritual impurity or remove the filth, or has changed by pure substances that have been admixed with the water. So when you make wudu and the water falls off of your body, and you know, let's say it's collected in a pan or a basin, that water is pure, but it's not purifying it. You can't reuse it to lift the wudu. Somebody else can't use it to lift the wudu, often to lift the hadath, to make wudu. It's already been used. Or if you use that water, if you have like some filth on your clothes and use the water to clean it, once the water passes through the filth, that filth has mixed with the water, so therefore the water can't be used. And then number four is impure water. It is water in which filth has been admixed with the water while the water is less than 2 qulla in volume, or at least 2 qulla in volume at his change. So 2 qulla, qulla is a Sharia measurement. It's about 216 liters. So if the water is less than 216 liters and filth has gotten into it, automatically it's impure. If it's more than 216 liters, filth has gotten into it, it's still pure unless the property of the water has changed. Its smell, its taste, its color. Tanning hides and bones. Hides, yani the skin, what we use for, what's leather? Hides of unslaughtered animals are pure, afwan, hides of unslaughtered animals are purified through tanning, the dibagha, except for the hides of dogs, pigs, or the offspring of both of them, or one of them with a pure animal. The bones of hair of unslaughtered animals are filth except from human beings. So if you slaughter an animal, according to the Sharia, everything of the animal is pure. You can eat it. You can use its skin. But the dead animal carrion, the dead animal that's not been slaughtered, we can still use the skin, the leather, by tanning. How do you know if the leather has been tanned? You would not be able to stand the smell of leather if it was not tanned. So any leather that you use, if you have a cloth or a bag, or a book has been bound, means it's been tanned, it's been treated. That tanning process makes it pure. A dog and a pig, or a dog with a pig, or a dog with another animal and a pig with another animal, anything that has the dog and the pig in it, it's completely najis in our madhab. And the bones and the hair of unslaughtered animals are considered filth. Except obviously for the human being, because the human being la yatanajjas, he does not become najis, alive or dead. Okay, using containers. It is permissible to use gold and silver containers. It is impermissible to use gold and silver containers. It is permissible to use containers made from other expensive materials. Containers is not a limit. Any tool or utensil, container, anything like that, as Shafi'is, we cannot use it if it's made of gold and silver. The Hanafis, they have a dispensation. Here we're just talking about the traditional Shafi'i madhab. Of course, in real life, you might have to take from other positions, because, you know, if somebody invites you to their house and they want to honor you and they bring out their fancy silverware and their silver in it and stuff like that, you're not going to say, oh, it's haram, I can't have it, I'm a Shafi'i. No, you follow another madhab. So there's a difference between theoretical fiqh, you know, the fiqh that we study, and then fiqh that we practice in real life. The traditional fiqh is that any utensil, tool, vessel that has gold and silver for the Shafi'i is haram. But it can be made of more expensive materials. And the reason is that Imam Shafi'i saw that gold and silver is something specific to be used for money, for the dinar and the dirham, and therefore it would disrupt the economic system if we were to then therefore use it to make utensils and things like that. Okay, the miswak, the tooth stick. Using the tooth stick is recommended at all times, except after the zenith for one who is fasting. The zenith is when the sun is at the very top of the sky and it begins to move towards the west. So the sun rises from the east, reaches the zenith, and then begins to move to the beginning of the movement. That is the beginning of Salat al-Dhuhr. We'll take that when we talk about the times of prayer. So he says that using the miswak is a sunnah all times except after Salat al-Dhuhr when you are fasting. because of the hadith of the Prophet عليه الصلاة والسلام لخلوفه فم الصائم أطيب عند الله من ريح المسك, that the smell that comes from the fasting person's mouth, which is not a nice smell in the dunya, it is more beloved to Allah than Ta'ala than the smell of musk. So because of that, the Shafi'i said, okay, well, we don't want to do anything to remove that. So it's disliked after Dhuhr prayer for the fasting person. Using the toothstick is, and by the toothstick, we also could use a toothbrush and toothpaste. So of course, there's a double sunnah in using the actual miswak because that's what the Prophet ﷺ used. So there's like two sunnahs. One sunnah is the actual miswak stick. The second sunnah is the brushing of the teeth to remove the stench and to clean the teeth. So think of it as that way. Using the toothstick is more strongly recommended in three situations. Number one, when the taste of the mouth becomes stale as a result of not eating or something else. So you're just like, you haven't been eating for a long time, or you haven't been talking for a long time. You're like in a library studying. Then it's, you know, your mouth is stale. So it's, you know, you're going to freshen your mouth. Number two, when you get up from sleep. So you brush your teeth the minute when you wake up. And number three, right before prayer. So for the Shafi'is, it's a sunnah to use the miswak right before you pray. Whereas for other madhabs, they use the miswak before they pray, like when they are making wudu. Okay, so wudu itself, ablution. For those of you who are attending live, and there's only a few of you, but if you feel like, because I'm going super fast, I understand. Let me open the chat box. If there's anything that's like super, I mess up or I'm not very accurate or people are super confused, if there are quick questions, then inshallah we can, you know, I'll do my best to answer them. But otherwise, I'm just going to keep plowing through until I get to my quota of pages for the day. Okay, ablution or wudu. First, we begin with the obligatory actions. These are the actions that must happen for the wudu to be valid. If any of these do not happen, then the wudu is not valid. Six actions are obligatory. Number one, the intention, just as one begins to wash the face. Why the face? Because the face is the first obligatory thing that needs to be washed. Everything before the face is a sunnah. So the minute you splash the water on your face, you have to have the intention in your heart. This is where the intention is, that you are doing this for the purposes of wudu. So number one, intention, just as one begins to wash the face. Number two, washing the face. The face is defined as where the hair usually starts in the top of your head, even if you're bald, right below the chin, and from the beginning of the ear to the beginning of the other ear. So all of this, that's the face, and it needs to be consumed with water when you're making wudu. Number three, washing the hands up and including the elbow. So the hands begin with the fingers, in between the fingers, the wrist, and all the way to right beyond the elbow. Why do you go beyond the elbow? To ensure that the elbow has been washed. So when you wash your face, you will wash part of your hair because you have to make sure that you've washed the top of your head, so on and so forth. Number four, wiping a portion of the head. So in the Shafi'i madhab, the minimal amount of the head that needs to be washed is just three hairs. So if you just wet your hand and you went like this, that would be enough to wipe your head. Because Imam Shafi'i read, بِرُؤُسِكُمْ in the Quran, that the ba is for a part of the head, and that's the minimal amount that would constitute a part linguistically. Washing the feet, I'm not going to put my feet in the camera, but washing the feet up and until the ankles, which meaning the toes, in between the toes, the whole foot, top and bottom, until the ankle and slightly beyond the ankle, for the same reason that we said that you are going to wash part of the hair and part of the elbow beyond it to ensure that you've gotten the ankle. And lastly, doing the above in the order that they were mentioned. Intention, face, arms or hands and arms, right and left, head, feet, right and left. That's the bare minimum Shafi'i wudu. If you do that, then you have wudu. If you miss anything of those things, you don't have wudu at all. So it doesn't count at all. Recommended actions. 10 actions are recommended. So these are the sunnah. So we go from the fard, from the obligatory things, now to the extra things, the sunnah. The first one is saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim before you start. Number two, washing the hands before putting them into the vessel containing the water. Meaning, this is before there was running water. Now we just turn on the faucet, so this sunnah we don't have. But in the past, you have a vessel. So you put water in a vessel. Now you need to scoop the water out to start to make wudu. So before you put your hand in to scoop the water out, you wash this by pouring the water out of the vessel and washing your hands. That's the sunnah. So then when you put your hand as the scooper inside, the hand has been washed. That's what he means. Number three, rinsing the mouth and the nose. So putting the water in the mouth and then the nose and then out the nose and out the mouth. Or the mouth and the nose separate. The mouth three times and the nose three times. But the full sunnah is to put it in the water in the mouth, in the nose, blow out of the nose and spit out with the mouth. Wiping the head in its entirety, right? Because that's a sunnah. And it also fulfills the obligations for the other madahib. So it's always proper as we conduct our acts of worship to try to make our acts of worship fulfill as many of the madahib as possible. So don't do the minimal wudu if you don't have to, if you're not like in a rush. Try to do the full wudu so you get all of the sunnahs. Number five, wiping the outer and the inner parts of the ear with new water. So the outer is this part, the inner is, you know, the back part. So like this, what, you know, after you do the after you do the head, you do the ears three times. Combing a thick beard with one's wet fingers. A thick beard means a beard that you can't see the skin underneath. So this would be considered a thick beard. So this is thick. So when I wash my face, I could just wipe over my beard. But the sunnah is to get inside and, you know, get the skin underneath it. And then number seven, running wet fingers between the fingers and the toes, which is called a tashbik, is to go like this to make sure that the inner parts of the fingers and then the toes are also wet. Maybe with the hands, you can spread your fingers out. So you don't have to do that. But with the toes, you usually have to do that to make sure that the in between the toes are wet. And then washing the right before the left. So with the arms and the feet, the sunnah is to do the right before the left. Number nine is to do each action three times. We know that. And then number 10 is to perform the actions consecutively. Consecutively is defined as the last body part does not dry before you do the next body part. So let's say I'm making wudu and I washed my right arm. I'm about to do my left and then I see that my mother is calling me. So I stop. I have to, you know, call my, is mama, is everything okay? Salaam alaikum, blah, blah, blah. Okay. We talk for a little bit. Now my arm has dried. I go back and I pick up where I left off, but I've broken the sunnah of consecutiveness. In general, all ibadat, the default sunnah of all ibadat is that it's consecutive. So when the Prophet ﷺ would say after the salah, Subhanallah 33, Alhamdulillah 33, Allahu Akbar 33, implied in that that it's back to back, it's consecutive, so on and so forth. When he would pray, alayhi salatu wasalam, his tahajjud prayer, the default is that it's consecutive, two rak'ah salam, two rak'ah salam, two rak'ah salam, so on and so forth. That's just like a general rule to keep in your mind. Okay, so those are the sunnahs. Now we're going to talk about, do you know where we can access the book if we don't have it? I think the admin people should have a PDF of it. I have a PDF somewhere, but I can't jump and get it for you right now because I think it's on a hard drive or something like that. So the admin people, if you have the PDF, if you could kindly share it with the students. Let me just check really quickly. In the Oh, wait. Okay. Okay, it's in the chat. Okay, cleaning oneself. Somebody's asking, can I use Bulugh al-Maram with Matn Abi Shuja for extra reading? Is there any benefit in it? Of course, Bulugh al-Maram gives you the adilla, the proof text that the fuqaha use, especially the Shafi'is, for the ahkam. But right now, you just need to get that mental map of these are the issues of fiqh first, and then you can add to that a deeper level of commentary. In the university course, each lecture I do, I begin by reading the metin in Arabic, its translation, and then its adilla, and then the commentary. So I do all of the adilla in the for the entire metin, for the entire courses. So yes, and what I said. Okay, cleaning oneself, yani cleaning yourself in the bathroom. Of course, you know that famous hadith that the Prophet ﷺ passed by a grave and he said these people are being punished and they're not being punished for something big. They're being punished because they did not clean themselves after the bathroom. So, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect us. So, I mean, it sounds silly, but it's not silly because Muslims have been known historically to be clean people. So when I find Muslims that are not clean and masajid that are not clean, it's very upsetting because it's the exact opposite of how we are supposed to be. We are supposed to be the most clean. We are supposed to be the standard of clean. Or not today. And that's very problematic. Anyway, that's why we have a discussion of it in fiqh, because it's part of, the Prophet ﷺ said, At-taharatu shatrul iman, that being pure and clean is half of faith. Imagine that. Half of our faith is just by being clean. Okay, cleaning oneself. Cleaning oneself from urine and feces is obligatory, it's wajib. It is best to do so using stones and then with water. Stones or something dry. So in the pre-modern time, they just used stones. Now you can use toilet paper or tissues or something like that. You don't have to, but you can. I mean, in other words, the stone here is a concept. So the metin, when you read it, that's why you have to have a teacher teach it to you so you don't take the wrong. I don't want you walking around with stones in your pocket when you go to the bathroom. If you're out in the boons, in the sticks, in the forest or the desert, yeah, you can use a stone or something dry to remove the ayn najasa, to use the actual physical najasa that's on you. In this case, it would be feces. Or if you're in a modern setting, I'm usually 99.9% of the time in a modern setting, use a toilet paper, a tissue paper, because it's also a dry matter. The dry matter to remove ayn najasa, the physical aspects of the najasa. So when he used stones, I want you to understand that it's a concept, not specifically limited to a stone. And then with water. Of course, in the Sharia, water is the ultimate cleaning agent. It's the best cleaning agent for everything. It is permissible to limit oneself to using either water or three stones to clean the affected area. If one wishes to limit oneself to just using water or three stones, each of which clean the affected area, then water is better. So most of the times you need both, but if you can suffice with one or the other, you always default with the water. Okay, relieving oneself. When relieving oneself, one must avoid facing or turning one's face back toward the qibla, the direction of prayer, when in vacant areas. So when you're outside going to the bathroom, you can't face or give your back to the qibla. But in a modern bathroom, this is not considered a vacant area. So in a modern bathroom, because it's an enclosed, specified space for relieving yourself, it doesn't matter which way you're facing. Out of good manners, one avoids urinating and defecating in stagnant water because there's no flow to cleanse it, or below fruit-bearing trees because eventually the tree takes from the soil and that's what we eat the fruits, or paths because that's where people walk, or in shade because that's where people rest, and into holes because that's where creatures live. One does not speak while urinating or defecating, except out of necessity, of course, and one does not face the sun or the moon, nor turn one's back towards them. That's how the Metin reads. But Imam al-Nawawi, who is the chief expositor of Shafi'i fiqh and who provides us with the Mu'tamid position in the Madhab, he comes many centuries later from Abi Shuja, he says that in this issue, upon further investigation, there is no offensiveness about the sun and the moon. But we read the Metin the way it is out of respect for the author. Okay, what causes you to lose your wudu? Ablution invalidators. Six things invalidate ablution. Number one, anything exiting from the private parts. The private parts are defined as the penis, the vagina, and the anus. Number two, sleeping while one's buttocks are not firmly seated. So right now I'm sitting on a chair teaching this book. So if I fell asleep like this because I'm firmly seated, I would not lose my wudu. But if I were just to lean a little bit and my rear was not firm on the seat, even if I slept just for a moment, that moment would cause me to lose my wudu. So sleeping while one's buttocks are not firmly seated. Number three, losing consciousness due to intoxication or sickness. You pass out. Number four, direct skin contact between a male and an unrelated woman. So in the Shafi'i Madhab, if a man touches his wife, she's unrelated, right? Because that's why he was able to marry her. You would lose your wudu, even if it was a light touch, even if it was an accidental touch. So for us, it's a very strict, it's a very strict point of law. Number five, touching a human's genitals with the palm. The palm is defined as when you close your hands like this. Each part that's touching the other part, that's the palm. But the outside, like this part of the hand, if you were, you know, you had to adjust something in your pants or your undergarments and you touch your private parts with this part, it would not cause you to lose your wudu. But with this part, which is what touches one another, that causes you to lose your wudu. And then touching one's anus according to the new school. The new school is a reference to, in the Shafi'i Madhab, we have a new school and an old school. The old school is before Imam Shafi'i came to Egypt. The new school is after he came to Egypt. Generally speaking, we take the opinions of the new school, except in some instances we take the position of the old school. Just a technical term inside the Madhab. It will come up very rarely in this book. Okay, now we'll talk about the ghusl. Somebody's asking, is touching the wife have to also be with the palm side, or it would nullify even with the wrist? No, any touching of the genders that are not maharim, you would lose the wudu. Except the hair and the teeth. The hair, the teeth, and the nails. So if you touch your wife's hair, or she touched your hair, that doesn't lose your wudu. Or the nails, or the teeth, I don't know, I would touch someone's teeth, but, you know, those are not considered part of the body that could bring about some kind of shahwa, some kind of sexual desire. So therefore, Imam Shafi'i excluded them. But all other parts, for the non-mahrim, if you touch, you lose your wudu. Yeah, that's our madhab. Of course, there are other madhab. Okay. Like when you go to Hajj and Umrah, you can't follow this position because everyone's touching everyone. So even the Shafi'i books, it says except in the Haram or in Hajj. Maybe Umrah you can go and it's not crowded, but Hajj is always crowded. So that will be an exception because it's impossible to follow that opinion in the Hajj. Okay, ghusl, the purification bath. Six, okay, so we just talked about wudu. So now this is like super wudu, right? The full-on ghusl. Six occasions necessitate the purification bath. Three apply to both men and women, and then three are specific to women. The first is intercourse. Intercourse is defined in the Sharia as the touching of the male of the penis to the vagina. That even the touching without full penetration, that would be considered intercourse. So one does not have to fulfill the sexual act or have to penetrate in the sexual act for the ghusl to become obligatory to renew one's ibadat or acts of worship. Number two, ejaculation of sexual fluid from both the man and the woman. However it's ejaculated, whether it's during intercourse or whether it's during masturbation or whether it's just like a wet dream or something like that. But the coming out, the emission of the sexual fluid would obligate the ghusl. And number three is death, which is why we wash the dead person except for the shaheed, which we'll come to when we get to the section on prayer. And then three are specific to women: the menstruation, the monthly cycle. Number two for the woman is postnatal bleeding, called a nifas. After a woman gives birth, there's typically a period of postnatal bleeding. And then six, the actual act of giving birth. So the reason they're separate is that there could be rare instances in which a woman doesn't have any postnatal bleeding, but the simple act of birth would require the ghusl for her to resume her ibadat. In my experience, there's always postnatal bleeding, but I guess somewhere out there, there's probably an instance. I know very little, but I'm just saying in my experience, I've never seen that. Okay, obligatory actions for the ghusl. There are three obligatory actions. Number one is intention. Everything in the Shafi'i madhab requires intention. Number two, removing filth from one's body, if any. So obviously, if you have any filth on, you got to remove it. And number three is that water reaching every part of the hair and the skin. So if you dove into a pool and you intended as you were diving that this is ghusl, and you just stayed submerged under the water for a few seconds, that would be enough for ghusl. If you stood under the shower and you had intention and the water was coming down, as long as the water got all parts of your, the roots of your hair, here, everything got wet, khalas, that's the ghusl. That's the minimum amount of ghusl. However, there are, of course, recommended acts. So that's the next thing he talks about. There are five recommended actions for the ghusl. Number one is to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Number two is to make wudu beforehand, so a full wudu with all of its sunnahs that we just talked about. Then number three, rubbing the hand over the body. So it's called a delk. You get the water, in you like this, rather than just like letting the water fall on you. Number four is performing the actions consecutively. Now you know what consecutively means. And number five is washing the right side before the left side. Right? So ghusl is pretty straightforward. Okay, recommended ghusl. There are 17 occasions. Of course, in the longer books of fiqh, there will be more instances or occasions. In this, he's going to limit it to 17 occasions on which the purification bath is recommended. The first is Friday prayer. The sunnah time for the ghusl on Friday is after Salat al-Fajr, before obviously Salat al-Dhuhr. Two and three are the days of Eid, Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha. Because Jummah and the two Eids are the times in which you're going to go and meet with the most people. So it's a sunnah that you don't smell bad. Number four is the rain prayer. There is a special prayer if there's a drought called the Salatul Istisqa, the rain prayer, which we'll talk about. That also has the sunnah of ghusl. Five and six are both the solar and lunar eclipse. There's a special prayer. We'll talk about them in the section of prayer, but it's also sunnah on those days before those prayers to make ghusl. Number seven, after washing the deceased. So you wash a dead body and you provide that service. It's a sunnah for you yourself to make ghusl. Number eight, entering Islam, except if the person taking the shahada is definitely somebody that has had a wet dream or a menstrual cycle, in which case they have to do the ghusl to get out of their janaba. So once they say their shahada, they become mukallaf, so they will be in a state of janaba, so then they have to make their ghusl. Number nine, insanity, after regaining sanity. Number 10 is regaining consciousness. 11 is entering into the ihram state, the state of pilgrim sanctity. 12 is entering Mecca and Medina. 13 is standing on Arafah. So the rest are going to be all related to the haram. 14, spending the night at Muzdalifah. 15 is throwing the three pillars, the Jamarat in Hajj. 16 is doing tawaf around the Kaaba. And then 17 is going between the Safa and the Marwa. Okay, wiping over the khuf, the leather socks. Wiping over the khuf is permissible, provided three conditions are met. Number one is that you begin wearing them after being in a state of complete purification. So you have to make full wudu, then you can put on the khuf. You can't put on the khuf in the middle of making wudu. You can't wash the right foot, then put on the khuf, then wash the left foot and put on the khuf. You have to wait till you wash the right and the left, then you can put on the khuf. Number two is both khuf, right and left, cover the area of the feet that is obligatory to wash when making ablution. So it has to cover your feet, your toes, all the way up to beyond your ankles, because that's what you have to wash. And then lastly, they are constructed such that it is possible to walk around in them. Another way of stating the last one is that if you dripped water on them, you don't feel the water on your feet. So for the Shafi'is, we cannot make masah on the socks. In the madhab of Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal, there is a dispensation for making masah on the socks. But in the Shafi'is, the traditional fiqh that we have, that's not permissible. It has to be leather or Gore-Tex or some type of strong substance such that you can walk in them. And then if you dripped water on them, you wouldn't feel the water on your feet. Can you wipe over the boots if they are the same conditions as the khuf? Yes, of course. It's even more sturdy than the khuf. So you put a sock on your feet, and then you put your feet inside the boot, and the boot covers your thing, so that boot now becomes a khuf. So you can wipe over that. But you can't take it off. You have to pray with it. If you wipe over, you have to pray with it. Okay, the permissible duration. Yani, how long can you do this? If you are a resident, and if you're at your home, like I'm at home right now, and I have the khuf on, I can wipe over the khuf for a period of 24 hours from the time I lose my wudu when I wear the khuf. So let's say I wake up at 6 in the morning and I make wudu for Fajr prayer and I put the khuf on, I don't lose my wudu till 9 in the morning. So starting at 9 in the morning, all the way until 9 the next morning, I can wipe over my khuf. If I'm a traveler, I can wipe over the khuf for up to 72 hours. Same thing. You put the khuf on, and then a few hours later, you break your wudu. You start counting the 72 hours when you break your wudu. As he says, the duration begins from the point one loses the wudu after having worn the khuf. Not from the moment you put the khuf on. It's from the moment that you put the khuf on and then you lose that wudu. That's when you start the time. One completes the duration of a resident if one wipes while a resident and then travels. So if I wipe at home and then I start traveling, I have to continue wiping for only 24 hours, because the rule that we have is when the state of residency mixes with the state of traveling, the state of residency overcomes. So I woke up at 6 in the morning. I put on the khuf, I lost my wudu at 9, and then I went to the airport at 1 in the afternoon. It doesn't matter. I only have 24 hours because I started putting them on and I lost my wudu when I put them on while I was a resident. And then number two, wipes while traveling and then becomes a resident. The opposite. I go to Damascus and I'm traveling. I put on my khuf and all of that. And then I come back to Cairo, where I live. The moment I come back home, I'm a resident. So I would only have 24 hours. And then lastly, for today's class, the invalidators. What invalidates the khuf thing? Three things invalidate wiping over the khuf. Number one, if you take them off. So if you take one or both of them off, you've lost the whole khuf thing. You have to start all over. Or number two, the time, the 24 hours or the 72 hours pass. Expires. And number three, something happens that requires the ghusl. So you can't make ghusl and then wipe over the khuf. So if you had intercourse with your wife and you had the khuf on, you would have to take them off to make a ghusl, or you know, so on and so forth. All the things that we talked about in the previous section that require the ghusl, if they happen, it would require the ghusl, and therefore you'd have to take off the khuf. We will stop here for today. We will pick up tomorrow at the same time. Wallahu ta'ala a'la wa a'lam wa sallillahumma ala sayyidina wa maulana Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Inshallah, I'll see you tomorrow at the same time. We'll pick up. It's going to be the same exact thing, the same speed, the same cadence, inshallah, until we finish the ibadat on Thursday, bi'idhnillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.